Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. From Israel to Iran, from the Abraham Accords to the Axis of Terror, from great powers to people on the street, and how it'll impact you, whether you're in the U.S., Europe, India, the Middle East, or anywhere in the world. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misgav Institute and your co-host. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's national security, regional cooperation, and international partnerships. Every week, we'll help you cut through the noise and provide fresh insights, not only on the most important and critical developments in Israel and the Middle East, but also on the trends and opportunities taking shape in this incredible region.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts so that you could keep up to date. And of course, pass the links on to your friends. We're just getting started, but we're already number 7 on news commentary podcasts in Israel. We're very proud of that. So thank you. And let's try to get us higher in the rankings. So follow, rate us, pass it on. And of course, you can send us your questions, comments, suggestions, and sponsorship opportunities to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
Our inaugural episode with former U.S. National Security Advisor Ambassador Robert O'Brien was fantastic, and this week we're going to bring an extremely important and timely conversation with Reverend Dr. Johnny Moore, the Executive Chairman of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the person responsible for bringing over 50 million meals to Gazan civilians, and at the same time, somebody who himself and his organization is under an unbelievable attack, not only by Hamas, but by the UN and other international organizations, and it's going to be an incredible conversation.
But before that, let's talk about the latest. As I was preparing to get on this podcast, I just finished writing an article about Netanyahu's upcoming trip to Washington. He's expected to be in the White House on Monday. A lot of things on the agenda: Iran, Gaza, Syria, which we will talk with Reverend Moore quite a bit about. But I want to ask you, as of today, there hasn't been any kind of decision made by Israel's cabinet about what's next in Gaza. But do you think that there's potential for a big announcement to be made in the White House next week?
It's clear that when, from President Trump's perspective, and I think from Prime Minister Netanyahu as well, they're hoping for a big announcement, perhaps a grand deal, when Prime Minister Netanyahu arrives at the White House. I think that one of the reasons we haven't seen the cabinet continues to discuss is that there are a number of really complex and critical dilemmas that, unfortunately, I think don't get discussed enough, and we should discuss them, that are going to impact the possibilities for ending the war in Gaza, for normalization with Saudi Arabia, for peace with Syria. And it's really important to surface these dilemmas so that people can understand beyond the headlines, beyond the slogans, what's really at stake.
I think what the cabinet's discussing in Gaza right now, right, they've sort of reached this fork in the road where they need to decide whether they want to sort of pursue the end of the war or to escalate. And within that sort of ceasefire options, there's a temporary ceasefire, right? What Israelis call the Witkoff option, something that American envoy Steve Witkoff discussed months ago about a 60-day ceasefire. Half the hostages would be released, hundreds of terrorists, Palestinian terrorists would be freed. Or do they want a more permanent thing? And I think it's pretty clear from President Trump's public statements and his Truth Social post that he wants like a grand deal with all the different topics that we mentioned being part of it. And Israel hasn't decided what they want. But I also think, you know, often what gets lost in all of this is like, is Hamas even going to say yes, right? We've heard and read many, many leaks from many different discussions about different plans and different ceasefires. And then in the end, Hamas says no. So, you know, we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think you've put it very well, this idea of a limited deal or a grand deal. I think it's important to clear up three illusions, which are very much a part of, unfortunately, of international discourse. First of all, obviously, Israel and all Israelis want to see our hostages back home. And it may well be that the price for that is allowing Hamas to remain in power in Gaza, allowing it to rebuild. And it may be that the right decision from Israel's perspective is to strike a deal that sees all or many of the hostages come home, which again is something that we all desperately want to see. But it's critical to clear up three illusions or misconceptions. The first is that Hamas has been defeated. Hamas still has tens of thousands of armed fighters in Gaza, hundreds of tunnels. It no longer has the ability to launch large-scale rocket attacks or large-scale invasion against Israel currently, but it controls most of Gaza. So in most of Gaza, except for a few small areas in the south, if somebody goes out and says, I am now in charge, not Hamas, or I am challenging Hamas, they will be neutralized, eliminated, have their legs broken the following day. And it's clear that if Israel pulls out, Hamas's fighters will emerge from the tunnels and reestablish control.
I want to interject, like, on that topic of that first illusion. I think that people ask, like, if Israel had such a clear victory against Hezbollah in Lebanon and against Iran just now, why couldn't they do the same with Hamas? And I think there's two answers here. Number one, Israel was prepared for both of those and have been collecting intelligence and planning for years about what to do if there's a big war against Hezbollah and if there's a big war against Iran. So they, you know, obviously you have to update all the time and get new intelligence, but they were really prepared for that. And then I think the number two answer is that in neither of those cases did Israel set a goal to fully eliminate either the, you know, regime in Iran or Hezbollah, the, you know, terrorist organization that, you know, for a long time completely basically ran Lebanon quite poorly, but they ran it. And so Israel was able to achieve its goals and significantly weaken both of them and say we won. And I think justifiably say that Israel is safer for it. But with Hamas, the goal was set that, like, we should allow this terrorist organization to run this strip of land anymore. They're right on our borders. We're threatening our people day to day with rockets. And it's just a lot more complex when you have to be on the ground all the time and you do it through airstrikes.
But I do think that Israel's goal of dismantling Hamas as the dominant military and governing power in Gaza is a feasible goal if Israel adopts the right strategies. And in the past, it's true, the Biden administration put all kinds of limitations. And a very important reason is that the presence of the hostages in certain areas has led Israel to restrain itself. But the bottom line is that Israel, until very recently, never adopted a strategy of taking over a piece of the strip and operating, holding that area until it was able to eliminate all the terrorist infrastructure and fighters in the area. So what we saw, and this was partly due to the pre-October 7th, the misconceptions of the old military and security elite, you'd have Israel take over a territory for a certain amount of time. The Hamas fighters would go into their tunnels, hide in UNRWA schools and their homes. And then once Israel pulled out, they would pop right back out again. Now, a few months ago, Israel announced the envisioned Gideon's Chariots operation in the Gaza Strip, which was supposed to correct this strategic mistake and basically involve holding territory long enough to actually eliminate the terrorists in that area. It remains to be seen, because of the potential now for a hostage deal, whether the Gideon's Chariots operation will indeed be carried out. Now, the second illusion is that this idea of a technocratic government. It doesn't matter who is officially in charge of garbage collection in Gaza. As long as Hamas remains the dominant armed power on the ground, any and all aid, and aid member includes cement and electronics and fiberglass and heavy equipment, any and all aid that enters the territory will serve first and foremost Hamas's military goals. And what will happen is that, let's say Israel gets wind of Hamas using such called aid to rebuild its terror weapons manufacturing plant, and it operates. The international community will say, oh, we have a technocratic non-Hamas government in power. You're undermining this new project. And I would say that's the second illusion, that whatever side of the debate or dilemma you come down on, we should recognize. The third illusion is this idea that a consortium of four or more Arab countries will govern or administer the strip, or there are those who want to argue that Egypt will administer the strip for Israel. Now, I do believe, certainly, Israel's Abraham Accords partners and other moderate countries in the region would like to see Hamas removed from power, care about the future of Gaza, and if and when Israel dismantled Hamas, they could play an important role in governing and steering the territory in the right direction. But nobody, no Arab power, nobody is going to do the difficult and complex and messy work of fighting Hamas for Israel. Unless Hamas has been dismantled as the dominant power in Gaza, no other Arab country will enter the territory and combat Hamas's attempts to rearm, combat Hamas's attempts to plan the next terror attack. This idea that we can pull out and Arab countries will do the work for us is a recipe for disaster, because what will happen is that Hamas will begin to rebuild, will plan a terror attack, will rebuild rockets. Israel will be forced to enter the territory to stop that terror attack. And the accusation will be that Israel is undermining this international regional consortium that is working to stabilize and rebuild the Gaza Strip.
And my understanding is these countries don't want to be there if Israel is there. Like, they don't want those two things to happen at the same time. Maybe there's some flexibility on that front, but that's certainly what they've set up until now.
I think that's right. I think they don't want to be there if Israel is there, and they also don't want to be there if Hamas is there.
Yeah. President Trump said last week that there could be an announcement within a week. Whatever the, a Gaza deal, and it's hard for me to see like a sweeping deal with an end to the war happening now, but there could be some other announcement. It could be about Syria, which our guest, Reverend Johnny Moore, talks quite a bit about. So you could wait and hear that from him. Maybe there are other countries who might join the Abraham Accords. Maybe there are countries that are willing to accept Gaza refugees. That's the idea that Trump's idea, that we should open up the doors and Gaza should leave. No countries have been willing to take Gazans, or at least not large quantities of them. I wanted to ask you something else. At the Misgab Institute, or at least some of the fellows at the Misgab Institute, have written about the fact that Israel should be less dependent on aid from the U.S. and maybe move from a model of military aid to a model of more partnership, developing things together, and then Israel could buy what it needs from the U.S. Do you think the strikes in Iran, where mostly Israel did, right? Israel cleared the path, and then the U.S. Sort of cherry on top, the final big bombs on the nuclear sites. Not final in some of the cases, but the big ones. Do you think that strengthened the idea that Israel needs to stop getting military aid? Because I was thinking that, it was touch and go for a while, right? When Israel started the operation, we didn't know if the U.S. was going to join us, which meant we wouldn't have necessarily accomplished our mission. I know that people are hinting that Israel has other ways of going about it. I think it would have been a lot harder. So for me, the way I looked at it, I think it sort of proved the point that Israel needs to be a little more independent, try to develop the weapons it needs by itself more. How do you see it?
I think that's a really good point. If I could just a concluding sentence to the previous topic. Again, Either the question of whether or not Israel should strike such a grand hostage deal is an extremely difficult and sensitive question, and I think all sides are legitimate. I just think that we need to make that decision without illusions about the situation on the ground now or in the future. Lav, to answer, I do think that Israel needs to move towards greater strategic autonomy in its military manufacturing and development capacities. I think it's possible. I think that this wasn't until recently a controversial idea when the Heritage Foundation, for example, raised it. It got some pushback. And then Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Knesset raised the possibility. We know that Israel and the United States will likely begin discussions on the next MOU between the two countries in the near future, because the current one is up in 2028. And the question is, can we move from a model of foreign military financing from the United States to Israel, which both countries benefit from to a great deal, to a model that's based more on cooperation and partnerships and joint R&D and mutual investments? It'll be critical that Israel is able to have access to the most advanced technologies. And in this context, I would argue that the cooperation between Israel and the U.S. should be raised to the level of the cooperation between the U.S. and the countries of the Five Eyes, UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. But I do think that Israel needs to become more independent. I think that Biden's both official and unofficial embargoes that we saw during when President Biden was showed how important that was. And I think you're very right. I think that the latest we're obviously very grateful that the U.S. joined the operation, carried out Operation Midnight Hammer. That was very significant. But it does show the importance of Israel's ability to act autonomously.
I want to talk to you about another topic. You brought up the Biden administration sort of withhold weapons from Israel. So another thing the Biden administration had done was to sanction perpetrators of settler violence. And we've heard a lot of news about that topic this week. Unfortunately, there were some criminals basically who live in Judea and Samaria who attacked IDF soldiers, basically because the IDFers were trying to stop them from attacking Palestinians on their own, right? Like not within the framework of the military sort of vigilantism. And this is a topic that I hate to bring up because I think that there's undue attention called to it in the sense that it's a problem. It exists, but it's like a tiny fraction of people, you know, out of the, I think there's almost 500,000 Israelis who live in Judea and Samaria. And if there's, you know, a few hundred of these people, it would be a lot. But on the other hand, you know, you can't just let people attack soldiers and you can't just let people try to take the law into their own hands. So the Trump administration has removed all those sanctions, but it's still a sort of like an international issue. It brings a lot of pressure on Israel. So what do you think the government should be doing to handle it?
I was recently speaking to a U.S. administration official who told me that you have to understand how much time and attention this issue of settler violence takes up, even among people who are very clearly pro-Israel. Obviously, nobody should be attacking Palestinian civilians or Israeli soldiers that are there to help protect and keep the peace. And I would like to see the Israeli police and security services be much more effective in dealing with this very small fringe of extremists who should, if they're committing crimes and destroying property and attacking people, they absolutely should be fully prosecuted. And I think that Israel does indeed need to do a better job. But it's one thing that's very important. This issue of settler violence gets a huge amount of airtime. And if you actually look beyond the headlines, the picture is very, very different. So most of these reports and the numbers are coming from the UN, from a body called OCHA OPT. Now, if you actually analyze some of the cases that they describe as settler violence, you find the most incredible examples. So, for example, you find numerous cases where a Palestinian terrorist attacked a Jewish civilian. The Jewish civilian or people around them reacted, fired back, fought back. The Palestinian attacker, the terrorist, was injured. And that's an example of, that gets counted as an example of settler violence. There was even a case where a Palestinian terrorist attacked a civilian. The civilian shot back, injured him, and he died, and the terrorist died the next day from his injuries. And the UN counted that as two examples of settler violence. One day a Palestinian was injured, the next day a Palestinian was killed. Another example, they count hundreds of instances of Jews visiting the Temple Mount, the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the holy site for Muslims, the holiest site in Judaism. No violence, but the very fact that Jews in Jerusalem went and visited the holiest site in Judaism and walked quietly, peacefully around the complex, that is counted as an example of settler violence. And this UN organization—
That is crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. And if you look at the organizations that they openly, it's not a secret, we cooperate with X and Y, they cooperate with not only the most virulently anti-Israel organizations in collecting this data, but some of the organizations they collect with are officially affiliated or clearly affiliated with U.S.-designated terrorist organizations like the PFLP. So I would urge anybody who's hearing these headlines about settler violence or decision makers that are dealing with this issue not to parrot UN reports, but to go a little bit deeper. And Lav, you're a journalist. Why do you think that this issue gets so much play in the international media?
First of all, I think that the international media gives way too much credit to international organizations and like doesn't scrutinize statistics the way you just did, which was very enlightening. I knew some of those examples, but not all of them. And it is pretty crazy. I mean, and you have to think they're working with U.S. designated terrorist organizations. And then the State Department under Blinken was relying on those statistics. I mean, it's just absurd. It's also, there's often pictures and videos of the damage inflicted. And that makes it, you know, much easier and also just more like appealing, attracts more viewers and readers when you have those things. And it looks like a clear-cut, like, aggressor-victim story because already the sort of narrative has been set that the settlers are the baddies, you know? So then you have proof. Look, these are the settlers. They're violent. They're trying to steal from Palestinians, etc. It's just like anything that sort of affirms the narrative that they've been trying to put through, they'll publish with only minimal scrutiny. Like, they'll only interview Palestinians on the ground who say that, you know, their house was burned down, which, again, nobody should be burning down a Palestinian's house. Like, don't get me wrong. Those people should be arrested by the state of Israel and prosecuted to the full extent of the law, is my opinion of this. But the proportion and the media coverage is credulous and painting Seidler on the whole as a villain. But I think we should probably move on to our guest now. Asher, want to tell us a little bit more about Reverend Johnny Moore?
So this is going to be a very exciting and timely conversation with Reverend Dr. Johnny Moore, who himself has been, I think, really at the center, on the one hand, doing incredibly important work for Gazans, but on the other hand, really at the center of this international media storm of misinformation, which has real impacts both on the GHF, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's ability to save lives in Gaza, and also on the safety of people. I mean, he'll talk about it. 12 of his workers were murdered by Hamas. So it's incredible that the UN and the international royal community is joining Hamas in looking to demonize and delegitimize his work. Reverend Johnny Moore has a long and very exciting career. He is a globally recognized human rights advocate, a multi-faith leader. I know him from his extensive work on the Abraham Accords. In fact, in many ways, he was doing the Abraham Accords and regional cooperation before the Abraham Accords were even named. He was appointed twice to the bipartisan United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, serving under both the Trump and Biden administrations. He has engaged with heads of state across the Islamic world and was instrumental in building bridges which led to the Abraham Accords. He is the author of 10 books, has appeared widely on international media. He was very involved also in protecting Christian communities throughout the Middle East, including playing a key response in the international campaign against ISIS atrocities, contributing to genocide recognition efforts and helping secure the release of religious prisoners in many countries. He also recently had a 2.5-hour meeting with the new president of Syria. So this will be a fascinating conversation, and I urge you all to listen and to share widely. Reverend Dr. Johnny Moore, it is fantastic to have you on the podcast. We really appreciate you taking the time. And I think the last time we spoke, I was on your podcast. And just before we finished recording, you said, "Oh, I have a big announcement to tell you, but we don't have time right now. We'll speak later." 3 hours later, I see a headline, Reverend Johnny Moore appointed chair of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. I was thinking, that's pretty big news. So we'd love to start with that. And maybe because there's a lot of, I would say, maybe misinformation or just confusion, maybe tell us, what is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation? And what do you do? What are your goals? What are you doing today? And just we can start from there.
First of all, GHF is answering a problem that everyone knew and admitted existed until GHF came around. And now everyone has amnesia and is, you know, willfully, I would say, acting like this problem didn't exist. And here's the problem. The vast majority of humanitarian assistance that has gone into the Gaza Strip over many, many, many years was almost immediately diverted into the hands of Hamas and then used for various nefarious purposes. And I'm not talking about some of the aid. I'm talking about like almost all of the aid. And so what GHF exists for, it's as a very simple mission, very, very clear mission, not a complicated mission. It only exists to feed Gazans. And in order to do that, we have to make sure that our aid isn't immediately stolen so that it can be sold to Gazans or used to prolong a conflict or hoarded, you know, meaning that the aid is distributed equally to people. And so the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, while sort of new to a lot of people, is an initiative that's been for more than a year and a half, actually preceding the Trump administration into the Biden administration. There was an effort to say, like, look, the only way we can really help the people in Gaza is we have to make sure that the aid isn't stolen. And so GHF was the answer to that. And so far in the first, just say the first month of operations, 50 million meals of food have been distributed to the people of Gaza in reasonable proximity to 1 million Gazans. not a single truck diverted. I mean, and we're talking about like every day, tens of thousands of boxes of aid that have to get into the Gaza Strip, distributed through our four distribution sites. And in an objective world, this would be viewed as an incredible success. Unfortunately, to my great surprise, we poked a number of bears that I wasn't anticipating, and not all of them are Hamas threatening our local aid workers and the Americans that are helping these people. We a lot of them wear suits and are in places like Geneva and New York City. You know, it's shocking to me that while the United Nations has never once boycotted Hamas, they boycotted our efforts to begin with. And we've learned that behind the scenes, they've been trying to sabotage us from the very beginning. And yet, I'm a Christian. You know, we have this turn the other cheek thing. I mean, my point is like, you know, as much as they hit us, we keep extending our hand and saying, you know, we want to work together. We want to collaborate. But unfortunately, I think we've inadvertently revealed a lot of corruption. Not our mission. Our mission's to feed Gazans. But we'd really like the people whose job it is to do this for many, many years to decide to help us with it, or maybe we can help deliver some of their food, or we can solve problems together. Instead, they spread lies that originate in Hamas and try to shut us down. And I can't think of anything more immoral than trying to shut down an operation that's doing what they're tasked to do, feeding millions and millions of meals every day worth of food.
Could you get into it a little bit about what do you think is going on to sabotage you guys? I mean, I've seen headlines that humanitarian aid organizations say that the GHF is committing war crimes. And also just we've seen so many headlines about violence occurring at the food distribution, which then suddenly turns out, no, it was a mile away. I mean, what do you think is actually going on there?
First of all, it's important to understand we didn't wait for a ceasefire. Okay, to start our aid distribution. We're distributing aid in the middle of a hot war, a real war that's taking place. And by the way, for half of our operation, we were distributing aid in the middle of two wars, okay? Because, you know, right at the beginning of this, you know, 1 week into us beginning our operations, the 12-day war started between Israel and Iran. And in fact, when the first Israeli operations were flying over Iran, as soon as the press reported that, like, we immediately surged aid into Gaza because we didn't know if and how long we would be shut down. And thankfully, we haven't been shut down hardly at all. There have been 2 days over the course of a month where we had to shut down for various reasons. But in a hot war, there are a lot of things that are happening. And when a component of warfare is the information war, right? In every war, there's an information warfare component. And the primary method of Hamas to try to shut down our operation has been information warfare. And so what they do is what we've seen over the course of this entire conflict is they release these statistics every single day. And they say that all these people are being killed at our aid sites or in close proximity to our aid sites. And this is their primary, way of it's both trying to scare Gazans into getting our aid, trying to force us to shut down, trying to force European governments to not fund us, trying to force the United Nations to continue opposing us. They've even tried to get like UN Security Council resolutions to call for the dismantling of us. I mean, it's crazy. Now, we're the first people to say, like, that there have been incidents in the Gaza Strip of civilians being killed. This is a war. But what's clear is that there's this very intentional disinformation campaign that is trying to say basically that every civilian killed in the Gaza Strip is being killed because they're going to GHF, and GHF is a death trap. Okay, so this is what they're saying. So we exist. Not to feed people, 50 million meals. We exist in order to lure people, you know, so that they can, you know, this is the lie that they keep telling. And I thought the media would be like, you know, a little more responsible in how they report it. The international organizations would be a little more scrutinizing. I don't oppose anybody asking us hard questions. Ask us all the hard questions. But no one's asking hard questions of all these other organizations whose aid has been diverted. And unfortunately, it's become a huge distraction for our team. I mean, one of my primary responsibilities is just every day taking the arrows. So our incredible workers on the ground, many of which, by the way, have resumes that are, that I mean, we could not have a more experienced group of people. that you know, they've been working, you know, our head of operations spent 30 years in the aid community. These American veterans, many of them have served in the most complicated environments all around the world. And at this phase in their lives, they just want to feed people. They've been like tending to the wounds of like kids that show up that with cuts on their, you know, on their head or their feet. Like there's a lot here to be celebratory about, but instead we spend every day fighting things that everyone knows is a lie. And even where there are elements of truth, the fact that civilians have died trying to seek food, there's just like no attempt whatsoever to like, what? Well, we're GHF. We're not the IDF. Like, we can't control what happens outside. Go talk to the IDF about that. Or what about the prolific evidence that we do have of Hamas intentionally killing people and then attributing that murder to GHF or to others in order to continue this fabrication?
It seems to me that Hamas has adopted a tactic where in the past, every time a Hamas fighter was killed, we discovered that he was a teacher or a journalist or a poet. Now we're finding out that any Hamas member who was killed in the southern Gaza Strip was just on his way to the GHF distribution site to pick up food. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions. One is GHF only distributing food via these four distribution centers, or are they also distributing via other methods to other locations? And what are those methods? And what kind of reaction are you getting from what you're hearing from your team on the ground? What kind of reaction are you getting from the Gazans on the ground?
I'll take the second question first, because it's frankly the what keeps me going in all of this, because, you know, I'm sanctioned by the Chinese Communist Party. I've gotten like lots of death threats, you know, from lots of I've spent most of my life, you know, in various ways as a human rights or religious freedom, you know, advocate. Like I've had lots of trouble, but I have never seen something like this. You know, the level of respect, I don't even call them respectable anymore, but like, you know, respectable elite organizations that we should like assume good intent, the way they have just like attacked us again and again, rather when the whole time we're like, cooperate with us, if we're doing something bad, like teach us, like let's find ways of solving problems together. But what keeps all of us going is every day we show up, and whatever all those people are saying about the Gazan people, we're talking to them, okay? And every single day we hear from them, and we're hearing things like one of the things that was a shock to us early on is we had a number of people that wanted to confirm that the aid was free, because in every other circumstance, their entire experience was that the aid that was coming in from the United Nations and these other organizations was being taken and then sold to them. So it was like unbelievable to them. We're actually just giving this stuff away for free. And so I think the response of the people of Gaza is what's encouraging all of us. And it also is sort of a gut check, because sometimes you read all these like crazy headlines and you're like, you know, am I deceiving myself here? Like what's going on? But we're actually talking to the people every day. And it really is in many cases, the exact opposite. You know, you have to remind me of the first question. I got too passionate about the second one.
I just wanted to ask you from a technical perspective, are you distributing just from the distribution centers, also in other ways?
Yeah. So the initial plan, it was to open four distribution centers, which we've done. It's to scale it to 8 is sort of the next step if we have the funding to do it. Unfortunately, because of the disinformation campaign is actually kind of sad. I'm sad to say it's actually working. Okay. It's intimidating. The controversy is intimidating European countries that otherwise would be joining our efforts. Some other interesting countries around the world that would be joining our efforts, some private donors, some charities that should be joining our efforts. But the goal is to get sufficient funding to immediately scale to 8. Those 8 also include centers more in the north. In the meantime, we're maximizing our 4 centers. 3 are in the south. 1 is in the center. The 4 together are in the best way I know how to say it is like reasonable proximity to 1 million Gazans, in that like every day thousands of people can get to us, and the Gazans themselves are adjusting to it. So like what you'll see is you'll see a couple of families. It would take like the 25-year-old and his friend and send him to our distribution site, and they'll bring like bags, and they'll collect you know, what they need. They'll open the boxes, and if they need more flour, more oil, or like whatever. So it's not like one of the lies in the press is that, you know, we're it gets impossible to get to us and all these things. Like, people are getting to us every single day. And then when you see those images of all those people getting to us, the next lie in the press is like, oh, this is disorganized. And it's like, you know, it's just, and by the way, as we scale, it will become more orderly, right? Because the issue is there is food security in food insecurity in the Gaza Strip. And so at the beginning, there's like all this demand for food. So we're just like surging as much food as possible. When we do it, it's called disorderly. When the World Food Program does it, they have a technical term for it. They call it self-distribution. Okay, that's literally the term that they use. They take a truck of flour, they drop in the middle of the Gaza Strip, and they call it self-distribution. But when we do it, you know, it's like chaos, disorderly, all these things. And by the way, we're not just giving flour. We have a box, and inside that box is a very, very carefully chosen daily group of food that exceeds the caloric count of the UN requirement. It's higher quality food than the UN distributes. And so we have four sites now. In order to meet the need, sometimes we do multiple distributions at the same site in the day. So we might do one in the morning, might do one in the afternoon. That's a big logistical burden, because we're not talking about like a little bit of food. We're talking about tens of thousands of boxes that have to be preset. And then we have to communicate with the Gazans, you know, through largely through Facebook, which is a very effective way of getting information to them still. When it comes to the North, we're concerned about the North. Everybody's concerned about the North. And so we have tried several things. And some of those things have been quite effective, but we're not talking about those things because it's the security environment. I mean, our primary goal is security, and the security environment is not our primary goal. Our primary goal is feeding people, but like we're more cognizant of security than these other organizations. And so it's much harder to do, but we've piloted several ways of getting, you know, smaller portions of food in the North. We hope to open distribution sites later on there.
I think like 50 million meals by any measure is significant and a good thing. But are you able to give us like the context or the proportion of how much of the food in Gaza is coming in through GHF and how much is coming in through others? Because, you know, for Israel, aside from the humanitarian concerns, right, there's this sort of tactical, I guess I would say, concern, maybe you could even say it's strategic, to keep it out of Hamas's hands, right, as you mentioned before. And I heard an interview on the radio this morning with one of the leading experts on Palestinian society among Israelis, Michael Milstein from Tel Aviv University, and he said, like, I have no problem with Gazans getting, you know, food in a way that's not Hamas, but in terms of it being part of the war effort, it's a failure because Hamas does not seem to be distressed by this. So I'm interested, first of all, if you can give us some sort of numbers of the proportion, what's GHF versus everything else, and also if you agree with that assessment about that it's not impacting the war.
If I could just add to that question, what is your assessment of the amount of GHF aid that is reaching Hamas, if any?
Great questions. First one, our game is not, our mission is not related to the war or strategic or any of these things. But we learn a lot. And I think the fact that Hamas continues to threaten Gazans has killed 12 of our local workers 2 weeks ago. And nearly killed others and tortured others. And then, by the way, do you know what Hamas did? Is after they attacked this group of local aid workers, Hamas took them to the Al-Nasser hospital and piled the dead and the injured outside of the Al-Nasser hospital, right outside of the Al-Nasser hospital, and wouldn't let them get medical treatment in order to send a message, basically. And yet one of the things that's remarkable to me is that the Gazan people, despite these threats, like keep showing up to get our aid. So I think it's a hard argument to make that that Hamas doesn't oppose what we're doing or isn't somehow threatened by what we're doing. Think of the fact that they issued bounties on the heads of Americans, you know, with Donald Trump in the White House, is like quite a irrational, and I think they've second guessed that in the last 48 hours. I think they're hearing a lot of messages, you know, related to the consequences of that. But I think it's quite clear that for many years, aside from prolonging, the conflict, Hamas made a ton of money out of all. They would take free aid and then they'd sell it. They actually make money at every stage. They make money at receiving it. They tax it. They'd sell it. They would steal aid for their militaristic purposes, and they'd hoard it in warehouses, so that if every other Gazan died, they could still live and continue their fight. Hamas is clearly no fan of what we're doing. They're trying to do everything they can to shut it down, which means that every time our aid workers step into that place, they're risking their lives in order to feed people. In terms of how much of aid getting into the Gaza Strip is our aid, right now, I think all the aid going into the Gaza Strip is our aid, right this second. Before the last couple of days, I would say during the 12-day war between Israel and Iran, a lot of the other international organizations, like the UN, many days, they didn't even try to get aid into the Gaza Strip. Okay, like we were the only organization that was willing to go in when the missiles were flying. At another stage of the last month, this has been an incredible education for me watching all of this. Like we have the data, like we keep track of all of it internally just to kind of know where things are, what's going on. At the beginning of our operation, the UN aid truck drivers were actually on strike because they were refusing to go in because they were risking their lives every time they went in. And then, it was something like almost every one of the UN trucks that were still going, because people in the United States and in Europe, I don't think understand that even while we were operating, we were providing additional food into the Gaza Strip. Not the only food, much more than everyone else for sure. But Israel was still allowing some UN trucks to go in, and despite the fact, but because of the issues in the north, and we're not operating in the north. And there was like one day where 55 UN trucks went in, something like that. And like literally 52 of them were hijacked at gunpoint by Hamas or Hamas linked militants. So in terms of how much aid is, there has been no mass diversion of our aid. Is there a circumstance? Do we probably have some people that are getting some aid and, facilitating some, market, or you can't totally control all of that. I'm sure there are examples of stuff getting to places it shouldn't, but there's no evidence whatsoever, anywhere close to it, that there's been any type of significant diversion of our aid to Hamas. It is still the case that virtually every time trucks of aid go into the Gaza Strip from any other organization, if Hamas isn't hijacking it entirely, and here's an example, there was a World Food Program truck that went in, I think, and when Hamas wasn't able to get, I think it was, it was in the UN or the World Food Program, but UN, World Food Program is the UN to a certain degree, but they're all these slightly different characteristics between all of them. But a truck goes in, Hamas wasn't able to hijack the truck. So what does Hamas do? Hamas kills civilians around the truck to try to keep the civilians going to the truck to get what they can. So this is a situation. But definitely the vast majority of aid getting in is our aid, and it is not getting to Hamas.
Just to clarify something for our listeners who might not know, which is that Israel stopped all aid other than the GHF earlier this week following these incidents where Hamas hijacked aid trucks. So I have another, yeah.
Yeah, before you complete that sentence, sorry for interrupting you, but what happened also was, like, amidst all of this, the UN literally told the BBC that none of their aid had been diverted. None of their aid had been diverted. Zero. That was the official statement from the United Nations to the BBC. And it was so crazy that literally the next day, even the French foreign minister said publicly that this is an issue. UN is just like lying through their teeth.
Yeah, I mean, we see that with UNRWA too. There's like pretty incontrovertible proof of UNRWA employees participating in October 7th and being members of Hamas, and that they deny. But I want to ask you, we see in some of the pictures of the food boxes people are getting and videos and things on social media that a lot of the labels are in Hebrew. And in the Knesset a couple weeks ago, opposition leader Yair Lapid I don't think he said it as a definitive statement, but he sort of raised a question whether the anonymous country that contributed $100 million to GHF is in fact Israel. So I was wondering if you could clarify for us where your funding is coming from.
Let me say a couple things about that. The first thing I'll say is that we're a private U.S. charity, which affords us the opportunity to keep our funding confidential. And, you know, that's been mainly our policy. Secondly, based upon the information I have, the seed funding for this initial operation principally came from a couple of countries, not Israel, okay, that wanted to remain totally secret for political reasons. And by the way, a month into this, I can understand why that was a question. And frankly, I'm happy they did remain in the background because I think what might have happened is it might have created a conversation that would have created the opposition it's hard to say that the opposition isn't effective. I mean, the information war is hurting us big time. But I think it probably could have been worse. And now, I mean, all of that whole conversation from my point of view is now a bit irrelevant because the United States government, you know, has signaled, as we know for a long time, their meaningful involvement in this effort. And they also specifically asked for other countries around the world to match the U.S. contribution so that we can do more because we don't have enough funding. And finally, I'll just say, like, for coming to Israel, five, six times a year for many years. And by the way, almost always I'm in an Arab country before or after going to Israel. I know all those countries. And I 2 weeks ago, I was in Damascus one day and I was in Jerusalem the next day. And so, you know, this is the world I live in. And one of the things I've learned about Israel is to stay entirely 1,000% out of anything political in Israel, like whatsoever. I have no interest in Israeli politics. I do know, however, that Israelis left, right, and center, I hear from, that are grateful for what we're doing and appreciate the fact that we're helping facilitate food to Gaza. And so I hope we can move this out of a political conversation into one where we can become allies on the problems we all know exist and can become grateful that we're actually helping people in meaningful ways.
So you mentioned something pretty incredible, that one day you were in Damascus, the next day in Jerusalem. You and Rabbi Abraham Cooper went and met with the new leader of Syria, al-Shara. Could you tell us a little bit about that conversation? First of all, what was your impression of him? How did he seem to you? How did he greet you, a Jew, an American Jew and an American Christian, a very two proudly religious men? And what you heard from him in terms of how he sees the future of Syria and the future of Syria's relations with Israel, and also the future of Syria's relations with its own Jewish community or its former Jewish community?
It's a great question, which I'm not going to say very much about. But first of all, it began because, well, let me say this. First of all, it wasn't just a Jewish rabbi and myself a Christian. I also had my best Syrian friend with me, who's a Muslim, and who fled Syria in the middle of the civil war, though never stopped helping Syrians. And so it was a Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim walking into the new president of Syria. And by the way, we didn't just meet with the president of Syria; we met with lots of other people, including all the Christian leaders of the major denominations. We met them in Damascus, but they came to us from across Syria and also Lebanon, actually. And I'll say, and then the meeting originated with I got a request from a friend of mine who asked me if I would consider meeting the foreign minister when he was at the United Nations several weeks beforehand. I had been publicly quite skeptical and very, very concerned about the future of Syria for all kinds of reasons. You know, I wrote one of my early books was called Defying ISIS. I wrote it about what was happening in Syria. The first time I was involved in meaningfully on scale, you know, helping in Syria was all like mixed and all this stuff. But I was, when I went to meet the foreign minister at the UN, as a private citizen, though certainly with the blessing of our government, I asked every hard question. And I said to the foreign minister, I said, this is very simple, actually, from a U.S. perspective, as I see it. We appreciate what you're saying. He gave a great speech at the United Nations the day I met him. I said, but it really comes down to two things. Number one, can we trust you? Can we actually trust you? You're saying nice things, but can we trust you? And number two, if we can trust you, are you actually capable of doing these things, of implementing these things you're saying that you want to do? And what I will say about that meeting is he gave me a great answer. He said, we are capable of doing it with your help. And then I asked him all the obvious 10 or 15 questions that you can imagine. And I can tell you after that meeting at the United Nations, and Rabbi Cooper joined me in that meeting. I sometimes say Rabbi Cooper and I, we're a good team because I'm mainly a diplomat and he's mainly an activist. And so like he's a bad cop. I'm a good cop, but we're both cops when it comes to these issues.
I'm the journalist and he's the scholar. So I'm the bad cop. He's the good cop.
It works really, really well. And of course, Rabbi Cooper and I, you know, have a bit of a track record when it comes to the region and in these in stepping into complicated places and trying to make something good about it. And I can tell you, Rabbi Cooper and I found that meeting at the UN that preceded our visit to Damascus very surprising. I was in touch with the White House and others before my plane landed back in DC that night. And he invited us to come. And so we decided to come. And we didn't know we would see, the president of Syria. But not only did we see him, we spent over 2.5 hours with him. We talked about all kinds of interesting things. And I think the first priority in Syria has to be the stabilization of Syria. But I definitely left that conversation with a very, very clear idea of what needed to be done, of how it could be done, and of the probability and the right time of it being done in order to see peace all across the region. I do think many of us, including many people in Israel, misread certain aspects of this new government, all for good reasons. And also, you know, I think any of us, we have a couple, those of us who focus on the Middle East, in the case you guys, living there, in my case, spending several months a year there, though I do have this wonderful privilege of being able to travel between everyone, you know, countries that don't always talk to each other. I think we have a tendency to be, we can be cynical, we can be conspiratorial, we can be a bit paranoid sometimes, and trust is really hard for us. And I think that's the case with everyone. But I always say the most valuable commodity in the Middle East is not oil or gas, it's trust. If there's no trust, nothing exists. And our visit was that. Our visit was a trust-building exercise, and it was far, far more beneficial than I expected. And so, yeah, I believe... I heard an incredible, incredible speech one time.
Did I just cut in? Sorry. Yes. With your, are you optimistic for more than trust? President Trump seems to be
very hopeful.
Right. He keeps talking about Syria joining the Abraham Accords. Do you see that happening?
I absolutely believe there will be peace between Syria and Israel. No question. It's just the time. None of this stuff can be done just because a couple of people decide one day to have peace. Like, there are practical things that have to be done in order to do it. And there are things there that will make the Syrians uncomfortable and the things that will make Israel uncomfortable. And yet, I think it can be, I don't think it can be done. I think it will be done. I'm not sure it's going to be done as quickly as everybody wants it, but I am certain it's not going to take as long as people think it might.
Well, maybe this is above your pay grade, but I don't think any Israeli would be willing to give up the Golan Heights. Is that like the condition? Is that part of why you think it'll take longer?
You should not assume anything whatsoever in any category from anything I just said. But I'm quite clear on what it will take. And I think in every side, this is very, very practical, very, very doable. I would say that the Syrian president, and again, I've had one meeting with him, and I, you know, and a long meeting, but I do think he's a type of, as Rabbi Cooper and I have both said in different ways, I do think he's a type of unicorn. He's different. You can't put this guy in a category. He is for sure religious, and he's for sure, comes from an Islamist orientation, no question whatsoever. But I'm not sure you can take this person and easily profile him. I think he's a very, very unique figure. It's a very, very unique time. And he sits in the seat that he sits in there today, in no small part because of a massive, massive, reshifting of the entire region. And as I was about to say before you asked your very, very important question, I'm intentionally not answering, but just not because I don't have the answer, but because I just don't want to get ahead of or any side of anything. But I heard an incredible speech one time that was, and the point in the speech was that this is a moment or the period of conflict in an era of peace. And I think that absolutely is the best way of describing everything. This is the last gasp of a lot of extremists. And I will tell you, when I met with Shaara, I viewed him as being more like MBS as almost any other of the leaders that I've met with in terms of his generation. And the way he talks about solving problems and all of these things, this is a younger generation of leaders, you know, in a region with a lot of older leaders, you know, who think only about the past. I think Shaara, like MBS, like a few other leaders, are future oriented. But listen, unless Syria can like get the basics right, and it's going to take help from the United States, it's going to take help from all of us, the country's a wreck in infrastructure and it's in the economy, like it's all gotta, you know, and I think the president made the right, he made the right decision by saying the United States is going to be a part of rebuilding, you know, the future of Syria, because if that doesn't happen, everything gets more complicated for everyone.
Jenny, we've had the pleasure over the years of talking quite a lot about the Abraham Accords and your involvement in the Abraham Accords, even before the Abraham Accords were officially announced, and the role of tolerance and interfaith dialogue and religious leaders. We've been now at war in Gaza for 21 months. We've been tracking very closely. We see that the diplomatic ties remain stable. The economic ties have even grown. Strategic defense ties continue. But it seems that people-to-people ties, war and peace, certainly public opinion, has taken a hit and a slowdown. What, if anything, can be done to restart the momentum of the Abraham Accords, of the war and people-to-people peace, which is really the hallmark of the Abraham Accords and what made them so special?
I'd say three things. The first one is it's not just the people-to-people ties that have weakened. Some people-to-people ties have strengthened. I think the scale is certainly the case. I mean, we saw a collapse in polling in several countries, you know, trends that we've been following for years. In many ways, this was the first time that a young, optimistic Arab generation had ever been personally exposed to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it definitely made peace harder, you know, to pursue and harder to maintain. But we've also seen some of these relationships strengthened. And it's so, you know, we can have open conversations about things. The second thing I would say is there's been an opportunity cost to this conflict. And we talk a lot about all the other costs of the conflict, but there has been a real opportunity cost to the acceleration of peace and the knitting economically and other ways of countries together. And I'm afraid we don't think enough about that. The third thing I would say is, you know, one of the interesting characteristics about the Middle East is that it can, for good or for ill, it changes very quickly. I mean, the policies can, you know, the challenge with Israel and the United States of America is that we're democratic countries. And so, you know, it's best system on the planet, you know, in my opinion, but it has its weaknesses. And one of the weaknesses is, we don't look to our leaders as they pivot us. We kind of have to pivot ourselves, and we, But in the, I think in the Middle East, and sometimes I say, you know, you can have good governments, good governance in non-democratic systems. And I think we have some non-democratic systems that have reasonable governance and people really trust their leaders. And so I do think that when this conflict is over, and, you know, and from my, I've always been praying every single day for this conflict to end as quickly as possible. I understand there are all kinds of things, you know, that are components of that. But like, I think once we move from a hot war, to we start to see a real into the conflict, that we're gonna, it's gonna create an opportunity for more collaboration on mutual problem solving, which has always been my position with the Saudis, for instance. Like I believe the Saudis would be in a much better place to contribute to peace if they said, like, look, we don't have normalized relations with Israel. We're not gonna do normalized relations until X, Y, and Z. But we care enough about the region and the people of the region that even without having normal relations and embassies and all this other stuff and business, and even though everyone knows there's lots of roundabouts to for mutual good, for them to just be public about it and say, like, we care enough about the Palestinians that we're willing to meet publicly with the Israelis about it as long as the Americans are there, right? And I think, you know, and the reason why these things don't happen is we have a previous generation that has like a playbook, and every time there's an escalation, they go to this, they go get the playbook, and the playbook says we have to issue all these statements, we can't talk to people, we can't do all these things. And I think all that's counterproductive. But I do think we can, the moment this war is over, like, and it should end, please God, you know, as quickly as practical, as quickly as possible. I'm an advocate for peace. I'm a peacemaker, and you know, it makes it, the hostage situation in Gaza makes it incredibly easy to quickly, nothing's easy, but it makes it, you can end this war very fast if that situation is resolved from, I think, from the U.S. perspective. I think that's from a U.S. policy perspective. That's a very hard problem to solve, but the quicker the war ends, the quicker everyone will get back to peace, and people are waiting for that window. The longer this continues, I'm not saying it makes it more difficult or more complicated. It does create more unknowns, you know, with a younger generation that's actually ready for peace. They're ready for all this to go away. But they're like these baked in things in the scenario that are products of the previous generation. Like, I do not support making people forcefully move from anywhere. You know, people should be able to decide their future, but it is incomprehensible to me that we have the only war in human history where if someone wants to leave the Gaza Strip because they have a relative in Europe, that they're not allowed to do that. You know, they're just like not allowed to do it. And they're not allowed to do it for political reasons. That's why they're not allowed to do it, because every Arab country, there's a difference between respecting the autonomy of an individual human being, you know, and I oppose forceful displacement of anyone. I believe that in wars, refugees, you know, ought to have the opportunity to rebuild their lives, you know, in another place. And they're always,
which I think is what President Trump was saying. He was saying people should.
Oh, that's what he was saying. To leave. No, that's exactly what he was. He was not saying that. He was not saying that the U.S. is like, you know, wants to empty out the Gaza Strip. This is all just like, again, it's the same thing we talked about at the beginning of this interview with GHF. This is all propaganda, most of it originating with Hamas, frankly, spread by governments and then spread by the press, people that should know better. All he was saying is, you know, and this is the thing to understand about Donald Trump that I think a lot of people miss about Donald Trump. He sees conflict always through the human cost of war. He always sees it that way. And when he sees the Gaza Strip, he sees a bunch of people that, because it is true, like, that while there are plenty of people in Gaza who were cheering on October 7th, there are plenty of people in Gaza who were the first and have always been the first victims of Hamas. And President Trump says, like, people should not have to live in these conditions if they don't want to live in these conditions. They should be able to go somewhere temporarily. We can help rebuild it. We can get rid of the you know, make sure the terrorists don't control it. We can, you know, if they have relatives in other places. He wasn't talking about emptying the Gaza Strip of everyone. He was talking about, you know, finding an opportunity for those who want to rebuild their lives in a practical way of doing it, because now it's not possible.
In the little time we have left, I want to talk to you about evangelicals and Israel, which is your background, as far as I know, before you were dealing with distributing food to the people of Gaza. A few days ago, there was this very strange incident where Candace Owens posted online a apparently fabricated screenshot of which she purported was prominent Israeli rabbi Shlomo Riskin paying off pastors to speak out against her and Tucker Carlson. And for those of our listeners who don't know, Rabbi Riskin is in his late 80s, I believe. He might not know what Bitcoin is, let alone be able to bribe someone with Bitcoin. But the organization and the actual CEO of Rabbi Riskin's interfaith organization came out and said that this is defamatory. But even before the Gaza war, and even before we had the rise of these influencers who use the expression Christ is King as a way to mock Jews instead of as a religious statement, the support among young evangelicals for Israel was on the decline. What do you, as someone who's an advocate for close relations between evangelicals and Israel, think about that? How do you think the situation can improve?
First of all, I think the decline is exaggerated, and I think it's always been exaggerated. However, we are seeing, you know, I would say for a long time there was like this exaggerated concern about a rise of anti-Semitism on the right, while we were watching this incredible surging of anti-Semitism on the left. Well, now I'm sorry to say, but we are seeing it on both sides, but it actually isn't the right. Okay, it's a type of pseudo-libertarianism. You know, that isn't a part of the institutional right, but because of the internet, it's much more influential. But what I'm actually saying is I'm not seeing some of these actors becoming more influential among evangelicals. I'm seeing evangelicals reject these influencers as they, you know, start talking about things that evangelicals actually know quite well. And I, especially in Israel, you know, I meet a lot of like, skepticism about, you know, the evangelical relationship with Israel. And I always like to reiterate that the best way of describing the unique relationship that 700 million evangelicals around the world enjoy with the Jewish community and with Israel, it can be summarized in a single sentence, which is, your book is our book. Your heroes are our heroes. And your values, while we interpret them differently sometimes, are our values. And this is baked into the evangelical experience. And a recent poll came out, I think it was from Pew, maybe in the United States. And it was super interesting because it showed that evangelicals actually keep their kids in the faith higher than any other religious community in the United States. And I think when you couple that with the fact that we don't have like hierarchy in our denominations, so there's, you know, we don't have a pope. There aren't a bunch of archbishops. I don't have to ask permission if I'm going to go start a church. The Bible is sort of our archbishop. And so one of the reasons why you have this like massively dispersed religious movement around the world, 700 million people, and they all generally feel the same, you know, 80, 90% about them at the minimum, you know, about the Jewish community and about Israel, is because they get it just from the Bible. It's not some archbishop saying, well, this is how you interpret it. And then I should also say, like, evangelicals, you know, it's not just in my case, in lots of cases, you know, we tend to be very effective bridge builders in many circumstances. In the United States, when it comes to foreign policy, we are the bridge builder between the Republicans and Democrats, between the left and the right in the United States. When it comes to the Middle East, we've been in the Middle East a long time. You know, the hospitals that most of those leaders, you know, that run most of those countries were born in were started by evangelicals. You know, one of the reasons why we can call the misinformation and disinformation, you know, from some of these actors around the world is that we have Christians everywhere, evangelical Christians everywhere. We have this incredible, in South Africa alone, like I had a lively discussion with a South African reporter recently, who at the end, I think, was so confident in the reporter's own opinion of their ability to manage humanitarian operations that I invited the reporter to just take over the operation if they were an expert. And yet, You know, I as I was thinking about South Africa after the conversation, I thought, like, look, I mean, we actually have enough evangelicals in South Africa alone that aren't politically active to change the whole political situation in that country. So, you know, while I'm not focused very much on politics, like these days as we try to feed Gaza, I think the evangelical community all around the world is a positive force, and I don't think the macro trends are changing at all.
Johnny, Reverend Moore, thank you so much. This has been a really informative conversation, an enlightening conversation. Hopefully, it will help correct some of the misinformation and inject truth into the discourse, into the dialogue. And I want to thank you for everything that you're doing for humanitarian aid in Gaza, for religious freedom, for interfaith dialogue, for peace in the Middle East, and the very positive impact that you've had on the Abraham Accords in the past, what you're doing in Gaza today, and what I'm sure you'll be doing, whether I'm looking forward to visiting Damascus with you in the near future, or Riyadh, or wherever the next visit will be. But really, thank you very much. And where can people find you? Where should people follow you, follow GHF? What's a good place if they want to get accurate information, accurate updates, was a good place for them to go?
I'll tell you, on GHF, the one thing that we do that none of the other organizations do is we issue a daily report. Every single day, we say everything we've done. We're not hiding the ball. It's there every day. You can see those reports at our X page, which is GHF updates on X. You follow me on X at Johnny M. That's probably the best way to keep up.
I could tell you, I find those daily updates very helpful. So thank you very much, Reverend Moore, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
In the hours after our interview with Reverend Moore, the IDF announced that it was reorganizing access routes to humanitarian aid to make clearer where people are supposed to go and to minimize friction between troops and the civilian population, of the kind that has been used to slander the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And that's all from us this week. I want to recommend that everybody subscribe to this podcast, recommend it to your friends, give it a good rating. Follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media. And again, if you have questions, comments, or if you want to sponsor a future episode, drop us a line at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks. See you next week. Bye, love.